you know, you can't get everybody to buy in. And if you can't get everybody to buy in, you have to find a better way to do it. The better way to do it is just have a national system that everybody's in. Now, unfortunately, I think that's going to eliminate the insurance companies from being in the loop. And that's why this is so heavily pushed to be either the Obamacare or the new, I'm going to call it Trumpcare. Yeah, I know. You shook your head. But anyway, it's, you know, this is really not for people. This is for businesses. This is for companies to be able to do what they have to do. And, you know, as a self-employed person like myself, it's nothing more than what I had before the Obamacare came along. It's the same thing. There's no real difference. It's huge out-of-pocket expenses and, you know, lousy health care.
Right.
So,
well, the health care itself is not lousy. It's the
once you reach your $10,000 deductible when you're 61 years old, yeah, sure.
$10,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, to be able to afford it.
Right.
I mean, if I don't want to have a $10,000, if I want to have a simple, let's say $200 deductible, let's call it $200, even though those don't really exist. You either get a copay or you get, you know, whatever. But let's put it down to $1,000 for someone my age. In order to get $1,000 deductible, I would have to pay over $1,000 a month for health insurance.
Wow.
And that's crazy.
Yeah.
Why would I do that?
Right.
Makes no sense. So in 5 months or in 10 months, there's your $10,000.
Right.
Right there.
Right.
So it just doesn't make any sense.
No, it's that's scary. It's like you take your chance. You'd rather take your chances.
And that's what a lot of people do.
Except that if you do, if something catastrophic does happen and you have to go to the hospital.
We all pay for it. If you go to the emergency room and it's a person that comes in that's uninsured, it goes back to the taxpayers. That's why it's so screwed up.
But don't they bill that person?
Oh, sure. They don't get the money if they don't have it.
Right. So you pay, they pay $50 a month.
It goes back
to
the taxpayers.
Yeah.
It's an absurd system, the way it works.
Right.
So, you know, and I know that it's making some people really, really rich because I see the $22 million mansions in Farmington and Avon. I see them. They're right there. They're all people that work in, you know.
The insurance industry.
Well, they run certain insurance companies to live in a house of that size. But it's just, you know. There's where the money goes. There's where the money goes. And, you know, and then you get people that are just barely getting by and, you know, they're making a decision between putting food on the plate this week or making their insurance payment.
Right. And generally people are going to buy food.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
That's really the way it works.
You have to eat.
That's the way it works.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. You know, there's, you know, bring me back Bernie, please.
I know.
Bring me back Bernie. I like Bernie. Bernie, okay. Bernie was... He was a realist.
He understood.
Well, he understood.
Yeah. So.
And, you know, when you're in Vermont, everybody's kind of, you know, open about this sort of thing.
Right.
And, you know, they get it. So what do you do? The senator from the north, as he was referred to the other night in West Virginia.
On the town hall.
At a town hall in West Virginia, they referred to him as the senator from the north.
Who is taking better care of them than Mitch McConnell.
Than their own senator, right?
Right.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
Pretty interesting. Well, there we go. We went all political again. But anyway, healthcare is, it's tough. It's a tough thing. And I don't know. I mean, like you said, natural medicine is a great alternative. It's not an alternative. It's a great addition to your healthcare because you will actually have a... you know, you'll have a chance at not having to go down a pharmaceutical alley and having to get yourself hooked on a bunch of quote-unquote legal drugs, which is kind of interesting. You know, there was a big sting out in California. Somebody crossed the line with a car full of opioids that they bought in Mexico to bring into the United States. And 'cause you can buy them cheaper in Mexico than you can buy them in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And somebody got caught with it because we have such an opioid epidemic here in the U.S. right now. And it's big money.
Right.
So You know, look what they're bringing in now. It's kind of funny. They're not bringing in marijuana. They're not bringing in heroin. They're bringing in opioids.
You mean opioid pills?
Pills. Yeah, pills. Exactly.
That's a tough one. It's just so interesting about the opioids. The opioid epidemic in this country, and that was something they were talking about on that town hall meeting, that there is an opioid epidemic
mm-hmm.
in their county.
Right.
Because it happens a couple of ways. They say that the way that people get addicted to opioids is because the doctors are prescribing them.
Sure,
and
they are.
Doctors prescribe them because they feel like it's not humane to let someone suffer in pain. So you have to give them something for the pain.
Right.
And so the way you have to deal with the pain is with a drug.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have your options. You have your options of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like your ibuprofen and your Mobic and your naproxen and aspirin. And those drugs have issues because they can cause acute stomach issues. They can cause ulcers and make you bleed
mm-hmm.
because even though they block certain inflammatory systems, they upregulate other inflammatory systems. So they do things like give you GI ulcerations and bleeding in the gastrointestinal system. And they also increase inflammation so that you can lose, that you can have more joint degeneration. I think we talked about this when we were talking about mm-hmm. Arthritis a few weeks ago.
Right.
So when you take your ibuprofen before that run, your run's not going to hurt, but you're wrecking your cartilage.
But you're doing damage to your cartilage.
Yes, you're not rebuilding
that's
your cartilage.
That's a good thing to explore and maybe have a little clinic on it sometime.
Yeah, that's something that, because a lot of runners will take an ibuprofen before they go out.
I used to do it.
Yeah, it's a bad thing to do.
I used to buy the big bottles,
right.
You know, the really big bottles, because you go
you
through
do
it,
that.
It's like candy.
Oh, yeah, you do that, and your cartilage is going to go away.
You're running down the wrong road, so to speak.
Oh, yes. So, yeah. I mean, it would be a better thing to maybe take some curcumin first
mm-hmm.
Or just generally eat a diet that's anti-inflammatory so that you would have, over the long run, have less inflammation and then take glucosamine to help rebuild that tissue.
I used to take that, too.
Right. Yeah, but that's
when
good.
I was running. No, I was do MSM and glucosamine.
Yeah, that'll help to rebuild your joints.
Yep.
That's
really
a good thing.
Was good. It really worked. I mean, it took a while for it to take effect.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, you notice that you had a lot less pain. So
glucosamine, MSM, and chondroitin, they're not. It's not a pill you can take for pain. That's
mm-hmm.
because I mean it will reduce your pain, but not. It's not a pain pill. What it is, it's rebuilding cartilage. So you're not going to notice it for several months out because your cartilage has to get back up to that point where it's actually cushioning your joints again. And once it gets there, you're going to notice a reduction in pain. That's how it works.
Right. It took a while, but then all of a sudden things were a lot better.
Right.
You
That's
know?
How
and
that works.
It's such a, it's very subtle the way it works, but it really works.
Yeah.
So, and running is, you know, I mean, it's a great fitness for your body, but boy, it is
it's
rough.
It's really hard
it's
on your
really
body.
Really rough on your body.
Right.
Bicycling Magazine had an article about running and
yes, well,
and
that's right.
You remember
it was
that?
Yes,
they
just
come
had
out
it.
A couple
Celine,
days ago.
Yeah, it was Celine Yeager. Celine Yeager had a great article. And
they were talking about the benefits of cycling versus running.
That's
and,
right.
And you know the
she was talking about how. Running causes a lot more inflammation than cycling.
Well, there's a lot more impact with running because every step you take is impact. So you're going to feel that. Now, that's also going to be load-bearing, which is good because we need load-bearing exercise. But over time, it kind of beats you up.
Yeah, she just wrote this. It says 7 reasons why cycling is better than running. There's a lot to love about running because it's cheap to get started. You just need shoes. Cycling is the overall winner. You burn more calories per mile, but most people can't run as many miles as they can ride, especially if you're a little out of shape or have weight to lose. When you strike the ground, you have a lot of impact. It's harder to run 5 miles than to ride twice or even 3 times as long. Running is also less forgiving of extra pounds, with every excess pound slowing you down. But when you ride a bike, the thing that slows you down, it'll slow you down. Your weight will slow you down in the hills, but that's pretty much it. You will still be just as fast on the flats because you can draft and you have a wattage advantage when you're bigger. But Climbing hills, you do have a disadvantage. So people who are littler can climb hills better than people who are bigger. And here's the thing about running and inflammation. Running beats you up more than cycling, even if you're hammering super hard. Cycling, I mean.
On the bike, right.
Right. So here, this is what I wanted to read. One study that compared trained competitive cyclists and runners exercising 2.5 hours a day for 3 days found that the long-distance runners had substantially more muscle damage between one and a third and four times more inflammation, and more muscle damage. Mm-hmm. 1 1/3 to four times more muscle damage, inflammation levels up 2.5 times as much, and muscle soreness 87% more in the runners.
87% more.
Yes, and in the following 38-hour recovery period than the cyclists. We knew running places more stress on the bodies, but how much more damage and inflammation was surprising and greater than anticipated, said David Neiman, who studied this at Appalachian State University. There's just more muscle trauma involved in running, and it's harder for the immune system to handle the damage.
Well, I can attest to being someone who was a competitive runner for 10 years and also a competitive cyclist for 10 years.
Yeah.
I can tell you that there's a pretty big difference in the breakdown on your body. And, you know, you think about, I mean, when I was running a lot, I was running up to 40 miles a week. And it was, you know, you go out and you would do sometime during the week, there was probably a 10-mile run involved with that. And you go out and run 10 miles and you've got nothing the next day. You know, you're really sore. You're definitely feeling the fatigue. You're feeling really drawn out because, you know, you worked very hard. And, you know, I go out and ride my bike 50, 60 miles and I get up the next day. I may be a little tired, but I could do it without any trouble.
Well, and you're not as sore. You're not as knocked out.
Right.
50, 60-mile ride, you're going to be a little subdued the rest of that day.
Right, but I'll compare a 40-mile runner's week with maybe a 125-mile cyclist week.
Right.
Roughly.
But that 125-mile cyclist week, the cyclist is going to be less beat up than the runner.
Absolutely.
That's just how it goes.
Yeah.
The other neat thing about riding a bike is you cover more ground. You know,
it's more interesting.
You get to see more stuff.
You know, don't get me wrong. For all you runners out there that are listening, I loved running.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed it.
It really does give you the runner's high.
Well, you get that from your bike, too.
You do.
You just don't realize it until you get off the bike.
Part of why you get the runner's high is expressly because you're beating your body up. So your body's making endorphins.
Oh.
Yeah, your body's making endorphins. It's making
to handle the pain?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Hmm.
That's exactly why. Now, it's not just that. When you get any sort of exercise, I mean, I just came from the pool and I had a nice swim. When you increase your circulation through exercise, you always feel better. I mean, when you increase circulation to your brain, you're going to be happier. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, you create endorphins no matter what exercise you do because all exercise involves muscle trauma and buildup and breakdown.
You create endorphins laughing.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that's more that, I mean, part of that is psychological, but part of it is the exercise involved in laughing. That's true.
But I think it's also because it's a happy place and it makes you create more endorphins. Isn't that right?
Well, there's something emotional about it and there's something physical about it. I mean, and laughter is a physical activity. And so anytime you use your muscles, you create inflammation, even just from breathing and even just from doing anything. Your body's always building and breaking down and building and breaking down. That's just what it does. When you do metabolism, when we're just sitting here talking, we're metabolizing stuff. I'm using blood sugar to help my brain think. And so there's a breakdown process and there's free radicals happening and there's inflammation happening. As I'm breathing, I'm using my diaphragm. I'm using my accessory muscles. So even though it's very subtle, it's still happening. And so you have to eat protein and you have to eat anti-inflammatory compounds and vitamins and minerals that reduce inflammation. And you have to bring that down. It's just that, you know, we've got into nice Celine's article here that really compares the difference between running and cycling. And so we've got a very stark comparison here. And so the other thing about cycling is, as we said, you see a lot more stuff, you know, if you're fit, a 20-mile ride isn't so long. A 20-mile run is huge.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, you know, 20-mile ride, it's like if you're very fit, that's not a super long ride.
Right.
If you're and so you can see a lot of stuff in that time. It's very nice. And so you can take bike tours. The other thing is you can carry stuff on a bicycle.
Right.
You can have panniers or you can just have pockets. And you can carry more stuff in your pockets and it doesn't weigh you down as much as when you're running. Because running, you really don't want to have extra stuff.
You also have a vehicle of which to carry things.
That's what I said. You have panniers and you can have a little box.
You have a bento box.
And
right.
You have other stuff to carry.
And, you know, going for a five-mile ride is not really difficult. But going for a five-mile run is an achievement.
Yes, that's right. Well, and, you know, that when they compete in track, 5 miles is considered a very long distance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
5K is actually
5K is a long distance, which is 3 miles.
5Ks and 10Ks are the longest events that you have in track and field.
Right.
And, you know, one's 3.1 mile and the other one 6.2 miles. So
what's a marathon considered? That's not track and field?
No.
That's a marathon.
It's a marathon.
Okay. Yeah, it's a separate event.
That's an entirely different event. Yeah.
Oh, so there's track and field and then there's cross country.
Yes. Track and field and cross country. And cross country will also have 5K and 10K depending on what level it's at.
But I see.
But that's pretty much it. They don't go any further than that. Right. If you're competing like in a you know, in NCAA or even AAU or anything like that.
So, like, nothing against, like I said, nothing against runners. And we're not saying that runners shouldn't run. What we're saying is that, what I've always said to runners who love to run is that you need to understand that running causes inflammation and it causes a lot of inflammation. And in fact, they've done studies where they take the blood of runners at the end of a marathon and they find that they're at the decision point of whether to send them to the hospital because they're having a heart attack, that they'll have elevated troponin 1 and they'll have elevated...
Wow.
Yes,
really?
Elevated cardiac C-reactive protein, absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So it's not that you shouldn't run. It's that you have to have respect for that. You have to train gently. You can't push yourself too hard, too far, too fast because at the very least, you'll get injured.
And bear in mind that, you know, both Dr. Fran and I are we do run.
Yeah.
So we're
not totally. We're not
down
anti-running. No,
it's
not at all.
It's just that we also ride our bikes a lot too.
No, I'm just saying as a physician, you need to understand that running causes inflammation. Mm-hmm. That's why you take your ibuprofen because you know it causes inflammation. But there are things you can do to minimize that inflammation. All right, so we're back to what Celine said.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of taming your hunger. Your cycling and running can both reduce your hunger, and they both reduce it about the same way. So they suppress a hormone called acylated ghrelin. So ghrelin is that growly hormone that you release that makes your stomach growl and makes you feel like you're hungry. So you're not going to tend to pig out as much if you run or ride your bike. And it doesn't matter if you're an hour vigorous running or an hour vigorous cycling. Your appetite's going to be suppressed for a while afterward. And again, it's easier to hammer out an hour on a bike. There's a photo here in this article, and it's women about to start a race, and there's Cola Vita girls in it. I wonder if I know them.
You might.
They're not, but the Cola Vita girls are on Jameis bikes, so this is probably a few years old. Because now they'll be on Bianchi bikes, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. she talks about style points. This is completely subjective. I'm not going with this one. This is what Celine said. This is not what I say.
Style points for what?
Yeah, you can buy some pretty snazzy kicks, but she says between bikes, helmets, glasses, socks, shoes, kits, caps, stem caps, saddlebags, arm warmers, gloves, jackets, vests, and endless assortment of components, cycling is a sport that allows the fullest expression of personal style.
I am just not going to go there.
We're not going to go there because you can get really cute running tights and really cute running clothes and running shoes now come in
and
not just high vis colors.
You know, there's a lot of things out there. So you can't, don't go there. And we won't even talk about your closet at home.
Yes.
Well, which one?
Well, I drew a lot of stuff out of that closet yesterday during the blizzard.
Yeah, very nice.
I'm going to, I'm downsizing. It's good.
Good.
What about the wee factor? She really said that. It's the wee factor.
The wee factor. It's a factor.
Cycling lets you feel like you're flying because of the amazing ability to use the forces of the universe to coast, sometimes at insanely fast speeds, and enjoy the wind through your hair, even with a helmet on. So, that's the thing. You can't coast when you're running. when you, in order to coast, you have to stand still. But when you're on a bike, you can descend. And when you descend, you get a break and you get to just pilot your bike and it goes of its own accord and it can go faster and faster and you don't even have to push it. It's the neatest thing. You can work really hard to get yourself up a hill and then at the top you get a reward, you get a bonus, you get a rest and you get to do this fun thing where you get to go down the hill and it's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is.
So that's the wee factor.
Yeah, there is a wee factor.
Yeah.
There is.
Very cute. So, all right. And the other thing is that it's like, this is what you always say. What do you call an ex-runner?
Cyclist.
Right. What do you call an old runner?
Cyclist.
Right. Growing old together. Cycling is something you can join no matter what your age. Mm. How old is Saul?
90. About to turn 90. He's 89 right now.
We have a lovely man in our cycling club named Saul Nesselroth, and we love him. And he's going to turn 90 on July 17th, and we're going to have some sort of celebration for him. And he rides a bike.
And I've known Saul for 42 years.
No, you're fake.
And so that makes you know what? You know how I met him?
Makes you pretty old.
We won't go there.
Yeah.
You know how I know him?
Because he used to come in the bike shop.
Right. Yeah. Riding a bike.
Yeah, 42 years ago.
Yeah, 42 years ago he's riding a bike.
He's been riding a bike
so
all this time.
So the point here is that, you know, he's continued to ride his bike for his entire life.
Yes.
And look, he's 90. And
I
he's,
know.
And he is very fit for 90.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So we expect to be celebrating his 100th birthday.
And there's some there's some 105-year-old guy who just set the world record for something.
Yeah. So that'll be exciting too. So yeah, so in terms of cycling versus running, if you're a runner and you love to run and you run well, the thing that I would say, I would never tell you not to run unless I really, really thought it was hurting your health. But I would never say running is bad, you shouldn't run. I would never say that. I'm saying that just to demonstrate. Not a thing I would say. What I do say is that running is something you have to respect. You have to respect that it does cause inflammation in your body. And as naturopathic physicians, we can help you to reduce the inflammation of running and so that you are less likely to suffer deleterious effects from it. You know, we do have things that can help you rebuild your knees, rebuild your joints, rebuild your legs. So things like glucosamine and MSM, as Ron said, and chondroitin can all help with that. Fish oil can help reduce inflammation. You have to keep your muscles topped up with magnesium because you tend to run through it very quickly when you're using your muscles. You need the magnesium to keep the action potential stable, and you'll have less delayed muscle soreness if you use magnesium. And you can get magnesium just from eating leafy greens, but you also can take magnesium supplements. It may be worthwhile to, I can do things like, there are certain lab tests that I can do for you, like cardiac C-reactive protein and lipoprotein PLA2 activity, where I can tell if you have cardiovascular inflammation. And if you do, I can help you supplement to help with that. I can give you things like hawthorn. I can encourage you to eat berries. I can give you berry concentrated berry supplements. Things to help to stabilize your cardiovascular tissue. I myself take hawthorn. I like to take hawthorn salad extract. And I like to take, I like to eat berries a lot. So you'll see me getting into blueberries, raspberries, goji berries, strawberries, you know, and cherries also. They all have those anthocyanins that are very good for strengthening blood vessel walls. You can also take grapeseed extract and pine bark extract. They also have proanthocyanins in them. So those are all really good ways to go. All right. So so there, we had a little comparison between cycling and running. And like I said, we don't believe that people shouldn't run. We just feel like people who run can benefit from having support, so, and real naturopathic support. So there are definitely things we can do to help you not be so inflamed. All right. And like we said,
what is it that we're eating that has that helps us with inflammation?
Oh,
because we make a lot of food, then you go, oh, this is great. This is good anti-inflammatory. So
we
like,
eat curcumin, we eat turmeric and ginger. Yeah, turmeric and ginger and essential fatty acids. And I eat a lot of chia seeds, which have essential fatty acids in them. We eat a lot of nuts. And, of course, we're eating a lot of vegetables. We have our huge salads, and we had a lovely stir fry last night. And, you know, all
those
things.
There was ginger in that.
There was ginger. And
ginger and garlic. And
you even put lime in it. And lime's going to have some.
I put lime in it. Yeah.
Bioflavonoids and vitamin C in it, which also help with inflammation.
Did you like the lime?
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that citrusy touch was, that was clever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm a clever guy.
You're a clever guy. All right. Okay. So, all right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, it seems ridiculous because there's snow on the ground, but I can't believe how much snow there is on the ground. And did you notice, I think there's more snow up here in stores than there was down by us.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
A little higher elevation up here.
Higher elevation.
A little makes a difference.
I know. I remember we had my friend Stephanie over on the weekend, and Stephanie lives in Flagstaff, Arizona, and her house is at 6,900 feet. So we were driving Stephanie from our house to the Dog Lane Cafe. And we said, Stephanie, it's a lot higher up in stores than it is by us. Our house here in Mansfield Center, my office is at like 220 feet. We're going to go up to stores and it's 700 feet, which is very funny to be saying to somebody who lives in Flagstaff.
Right, who lives at 7,000 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
funny.
So how do you like all the air here? She's like, oh, I love it. She said she loves to come back home to visit for that reason. She loves because there's air and there's moisture.
Oh, it's not thin like it is out there.
No.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
A
Forget
big
about that.
Difference.
So all of a sudden you're getting oxygenated.
Yes, and I have the opposite problem. When I go out there, I don't feel good until I come home.
I remember doing that when going out to my sister's house. My sister's house sat right around 6,000 feet.
Yeah.
Just north of Denver. And
didn't you feel weird?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I used to, you know, when I would go out there because I was traveling, I would either, you know, I'd usually run when I would run from her house, and it was just a lot of work. And then occasionally I ride my bike if I had a bike with me, and that was, like, amazing because then you could start at 6,000 feet, and you could climb way more than seven. You could climb way, way up.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah, it's
no,
crazy
that's
stuff.
Okay.
Oh, it's fun. Oh, it's really
I'm sure
fun.
It's fun. Yeah, I just really worry about getting altitude. That I don't mind the work. I would mind getting altitude sickness because that's dangerous. It makes me very nervous. Those people who came, we had people in our bike club who went to the Bicycle Tour of Colorado, and they would go and do that. They'd be in Colorado for 2 or 3 days, and then they do these tours where they go up to Estes Park and Steamboat Springs, and those sit at over 10,000 feet, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so, and they wouldn't have, see, the thing with altitude, the thing that happens is you have a certain number of red blood cells in your body. And the red blood cells are what carry oxygen to all of the cells in your body. When you're and you have a normal amount of red blood cells, if you're not anemic, you have a nice amount of red blood cells that will support you at this altitude right here. So, you know, Ron and I are sitting here in stores. We're coming to you from somewhere between 600 and 700 feet. Big deal. Okay. Right. So there's a lot of air here relative to 10,000 feet. So the percentage of oxygen in the air goes down the higher you get. And it's not significant. It's not so significant when you're at 1,000 feet, but when you're at 10,000 feet, it's significant. Right? When you're at, and I can tell you when you're at 5,000 feet, it's significant. Because when I go visit Lori at Prescott, her city sits at around 5, and I feel a little weird when I'm there, and I don't feel right till I come home. I'll have sudden bouts of dizziness and fatigue, and my digestion is off. It's strange.
Yeah.
And I don't feel right, and as soon as I get home, I feel better again. And that would go away if I would stay there for 2 weeks, because you need 2 weeks to acclimate. If you want to acclimate to an altitude, that's why they have base camps when people summit Everest. You have to spend time at 10,000 feet before you can go up to 20,000 feet so that you can get your blood cells. What happens is you make more red blood cells. So Lori and Stephanie have more red blood cells than I have. And they have a higher capacity. When you live at altitude, your body adapts. You grow more red blood cells. You grow more blood vessels. Your chest expands, your lungs get a little bigger. You have all kinds of adaptations that happen at altitude. And you can adapt to it. It's just that if you go there and you expect to perform after 3 days of being at that altitude, it's not going to work so well. And I've seen people go out there and get sick. They get altitude sickness when they get up there. And that scares me. So, I get mild discomfort when I get up there. And, you know, I'll ride my bike when I go to Lori's, and I'll ride from, her house is at 5,000. And if you go out Route 89 out there, you get up to 6,100 feet.
Mm.
I can do it. I'll cough a little. It's not great, but you do it. What are you going to do? So, all right. So we have a little bit more time left. Let me see. Let me talk about my ribs.
You can, okay.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing to talk about. So one of the things that can happen is you can hurt your ribs. If you fall off your bike, if you fall off your bike, you can break your ribs. You can also break your collarbone. And collarbones and ribs, they usually don't splint unless it's very bad, in which case that your collarbone, they'll do a surgery and they'll put a rod in there. Mm-hmm. But if you've just cracked it, they're like, goodbye, 4 to 6 weeks. See you later.
Yeah, don't cough, don't sneeze, don't laugh.
Maybe wear a splint. So,
don't cough, don't sneeze, don't laugh.
Don't cough, don't sneeze, don't laugh. So what I usually do for that is because they're like all don't cough, don't sneeze, don't laugh, there are some things you can do for that. One of the things is you can tape the areas. That's a very mm-hmm. easy thing to do, and we still haven't done that. We should do that today. Let's tape my ribs.
I can do that.
We're gonna tape them, and because tape can hold them in place and draw mm-hmm. circulation and energy to the area to help with healing. And you can also, what I like to do is I like to give topical salves because you can take some things to help heal the area internally as well. So if you actually have a broken bone of anywhere, I like to give bone set and comfrey. I give bone set and comfrey tinctures, which are herbs that can help to mend bones. You can also take extra calcium and magnesium supplements, and you can take things that women take for bone density. Well, you can mm-hmm. take those for a period of time while you're helping to knit your bones. And there's supplements that'll have good quality calcium, not calcium carbonate, but a calcium that's very absorbable. Calcium, magnesium, perhaps boron, zinc, copper, all things that are components of bone. Vitamin K2, which helps to direct calcium. It's a traffic director of calcium. It helps to direct calcium away from making calcifications where you don't want them and to put them in places you do want them, like your bones. Yeah.
And a large mountain also, K2.
I know, right? Is that like so funny? K2 is also a large mountain. That's, yeah. That's right. And then the other thing is... vitamin D, very important. So you have to look at your vitamin D level. I like to see people's vitamin D levels at least at 55 nanograms per milliliter. And if it's not, I help people with a dose of vitamin D that will work for them. And it's different for different people. Some people, so the dose is different because people also have, they differ in their ability to absorb vitamin D. You can do genetic testing to find out people's VD, it's VD, TAQ. Anyway, it's a gene, a genetic polymorphism that makes it that dictates how well you absorb your vitamin D. And so people differ. And I think mine's probably not that great because I take a lot of vitamin D. My vitamin D doesn't go up very fast, so I'm probably a little deficient there. And that may also be why I'm wondering too. Some people are not so bothered by the winter. And others get seasonal affective disorder,
mm-hmm.
right? So I wonder if it would be worth it. It would be interesting to know for the people with seasonal affective disorder, well, for everybody, to know what their vitamin D absorption status is. So if they have a polymorphism Ooh. Where they don't absorb vitamin D as well, you would think that they would tend to suffer more in the winter.
Hmm.
And what happened to me, as soon as I went to Florida, my cough went away, right? So I'm suddenly making a lot more vitamin D. Like you can't really make vitamin D from the sun right now because you're not outside. If you are, you're covered up. The sun isn't quite ready. Soon the sun will be rising above the horizon enough to make vitamin D.
I was going to say we're not high enough up. we're right. or low enough so that we're getting the more intense rays that are coming down on us, right?
Yes. Well, also the sun has to rise above a certain altitude above the horizon.
Exactly.
So it has to be at 50 degrees above the horizon. If it never makes it to 50 degrees above the horizon, you can't make vitamin D. And most of the year, that's how it is in Florida. The closer you get to the equator, the more of the year that the sun will spend there. For us, because we're very close to halfway between the equator and the North Pole, the halfway between the equator and North Pole is the 45th parallel, which goes through Falmouth, Nova Scotia, someplace in Maine, goes through Salem, Oregon. Anyway, we're south of there. We're at almost, we're like 41 and change, the high 41s. We're almost at 42 here. And so we're almost halfway between the equator and the North Pole. So about half the year, the sun never makes it above 50 degrees above the horizon.
So what do you do about that?
You take vitamin D.
Okay, so the only way around it is a supplement?
Pretty much. If you have problems, well, not necessarily. If you're a happy and healthy person, if you come in and you're happy and healthy and you rarely get sick and you have no deleterious health parameters and your vitamin D is within the normal range, even if it's like in the 30s or 40s, and you're absolutely healthy, I'm not going to tell you to take vitamin D.
Okay.
But that's not what I see with most people. Most people come in and they're coming in because they have something going on that they're not doing well with. And if I see that their vitamin D is out of range, I'm going to tell them to take vitamin D. And in fact, if their vitamin D is low normal, I'm going to still tell them to take vitamin D because it makes them feel better. But also, if you're trying to knit bones, you want to make sure your vitamin D level is adequate. And so that's one of the things that you make sure that the person has on board if they're trying to mend ribs and collarbones. So the other thing with ribs and collarbones is I will encourage people to use salves. I have comfrey salve and comfrey oil, which I've been putting on that sore spot, and I feel better right away. It's really remarkable. And so I think that I have a fracture salve that has comfrey and boneset and Romania and teasel and a whole bunch of other herbs that can help to mend bones. So you put them on topically because, you know, there's not a whole lot else you can do. You can take comfrey and boneset and all those other herbs internally, and you can also put them on topically. We think that I don't have a broken bone because at the chiropractor used a muscle stimulator on me, and he put it right on that area, and it felt good. If I had had a fracture, it would have hurt because, you know, when you put a tuning fork on a fracture, it hurts. So if you put anything that vibrates on a broken bone, it'll be painful. And mine wasn't painful, so I just probably...
How about a bruise?
Tore some... I don't know if it's bruised or if a bruise probably would have cleared up by now. I think what I did is I tore some soft tissue. I tore some cartilage in
between. It's because you were hacking like a four-pack-a-day smoker.
But the other problem, and then I went to Florida and it all got better. But the problem is occasionally I sneeze.
Oh,
and
boy.
And I do planks and I swim and I ride a bike and I lift weights. Do you know what the worst thing that keeps setting me back with this soreness is?
Sneezing. I know.
Not coughing because I can control.
And so just so you guys can get a picture of this out there, I hear the sneeze in the other room and then I hear this kind of screech right afterwards.
Ow! Yeah.
It's kind of, I mean, I know it's not funny, but it is kind of funny.
Every
time you sneeze, I hear, ouch, yikes.
It's bad.
It's really funny.
It's not fun. So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm making fun of you.
Anyway, so this comfrey salve and comfrey oil, I'm very happy with because if I'm sore, if I put it on, it hurts less right away. It's pretty amazing. So that's something that you can do. All right. So we just have a few more minutes left.
I had a caller a few weeks ago, and I don't think that we addressed this. And stop me if we did, but I don't think we addressed this. I had a caller called in, and she said her son has incredibly sweaty feet,
Oh.
Did we address that a few weeks ago? I can't remember if we did or not. I may have just discussed it with you.
And
but
people...
we're talking about so sweaty that she said you can wring his socks out.
Wow.
So do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I would have... Were they complaining about odor as well?
I'm certain that odor would go along with feet that you can wring a sock out with, yes.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
That's why I'm asking. Were they complaining? Because what were they complaining about it?
They were just complaining about the fact that his feet
the
sweat
actual
so much.
Sweat, yeah. Not necessarily the odor. Yeah, because sometimes people complain about both, and they're linked but separate issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, okay. So this child has, how old is this person?
I don't have an age.
Yeah, that would be helpful to know too.
Yeah.
Because
yep.
If it's a little kid, that's a little more telling than if it's an adolescent. So that it's kind of helpful just because if it's a little child, then it's obviously a genetic condition. I mean, it's probably genetic anyway, but
mm-hmm.
It could be something that's pushed by adolescent hormones. And the trials and tribulations of adolescence. So anyway, so this person has excessive sweating of the feet and nowhere else.
Yes.
Huh.
All right. Seems to be.
And does the excessive sweating occur while they are still, or does it also occur when they're moving?
I made these notes
having
so
exercise?
Long ago. I don't have details.
Okay. All right. So we're gonna assume that because they're complaining, because when I go ride my bike 30 miles in the heat, I come home and I could probably wring out my socks. If it's really hot and very humid, I get to that point.
Hmm.
So, and I expect that. I don't see that as a problem. I see that as goes with
but
the territory.
You're also very physical that with
yeah,
that too.
Right.
Your whole body is sweating.
There
at
are
that
those
point.
Days when you're sweating, you're out in the heat and you're sweating and it's humid out and there's nowhere for it to go. So your clothes get absolutely soaked. That happens.
I am led to believe that this was just the feet.
Right. It's just the feet. And we're going to assume that it's not from exercise, that it's when he's still.
Correct.
So he's got hyperhidrosis in his feet. So he's got very active exocrine glands in that area. So this is a situation where I'd find out what else is going on. Is the person stressed? Does it happen more when they're stressed? What situations does it happen in? Or is
yeah.
it all the time? Those are key things that you want to know. So it's all kinds of questions you have to ask the person.
Right.
So anyway, if this person has it so bad that it's that uncomfortable, this is a time when you actually might want to do some... you hate to tell people to put aluminum hydroxide on their feet or stuff with aluminum in it. I would try because you want to have stuff that will reduce the sweating. But what reduces sweating, unfortunately, is reducing activity of the nerves that lead to the sweating and also putting stuff in that help the sweat glands locally to calm down. I would try bentonite clay because bentonite clay is going to have a large proportion of different minerals. It might have a tiny bit of aluminum in them. You hate to say use aluminum hydroxide because aluminum hydroxide is what's in commercial antiperspirants.
Oh, yeah.
And you get prescription strength, which you can put on the feet, and it will help to reduce them. The other thing I would want to know is what's this person's magnesium status? Because if your magnesium status is low, you're going to tend to sweat more. And so, eat your veggies. Eat your green veggies, maybe take magnesium.
Right.
That would be something that I would suggest. I would want to find out stuff like that. And I'd want to find out what else is going on in the person's body that we could tweak. Because you're looking at a possible local sympathectomy where you do surgery to reduce the nerve feed to the feet. But you don't really want to do that because that could affect circulation.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do that.
So in the meantime, I would do the bentonite clay. Bentonite
mm-hmm.
clay would be a good idea and magnesium. And maybe even local magnesium that if you were to do a powder that had some magnesium directly or a gel, because you can get magnesium gel you can put on the feet because
mm-hmm.
magnesium can help to reduce sweating. I would also want to know if that person is taking an antidepressant because SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Zoloft, can increase sweating.
So there's a lot of factors involved.
A lot of factors involved. But there's a few things that might be of help. All right. So you're listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath. And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.